listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Tonight we are going to have two wonderful guests, Tim Page and Sasha Anawalt, talking about Tim's book, Parallel Play, Growing Up with Undiagnosed Asperger's. But in case you were confused and thinking about tomorrow night when the program is about growing up Jewish under Stalin, you know, we understand if there was a little confusion. But that's going to be a great program, too. Many of you here tonight also, I'm sure, read Tim Page's remarkable piece in The New Yorker, published in 2007. It was a glimpse of a precocious but troubled boyhood in working-class Connecticut, a coming-of-age marked by intense social anxiety and obsessive fixations, and as well the spark of genius and a calling to the arts. Janet Maslin in The New York Times called his memoir an improbably lovely memoir about the loneliness that has made him feel throughout his life that he is not quite a mammal. Ooh, that changed our voice there. Tim Page won the Pulitzer Prize for music criticism in 1997, just 3 years before he was finally diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. He is now a professor of journalism and music at USC. He's been a music critic at the New York Times, Newsday, and the Washington Post. In the early 90s, his research led to the discovery of the papers and diaries of Dawn Powell, which in turn led to the subsequent reissue of the majority of her novels. In 1998, he published a highly acclaimed biography of Dawn Powell, and in 2001, he edited and annotated the Library of America's two-volume collection of her work. In conversation with Tim Page tonight, we have the effervescent Sasha Anawalt, a force for good in the arts in L.A. and everywhere else. Sasha is a faculty member at USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. She founded the master's degree program in specialized journalism in 2008 and directs the USC Annenberg Getty Arts Journalism Program, as well as the NEA Arts Journalism Institute in theater and musical theater. She is a longtime dance critic. She was a longtime dance critic and still writes on the arts, and she is the author of the best-selling cultural biography, The Joffrey Ballet, Robert Joffrey, and the Making of an American Dance Company. And her writing has appeared in many publications. Please welcome Tim Page and Sasha Anawalt. Thank you.
Hello, hello. Tim is my colleague at USC Annenberg, and he teaches writing, and we were talking about writing in the green room. He has some sort of weird mojo with students. He can transform people into great, really good writers and take them from wherever level they are and spring them up into some place where they wish to be. This book is so beautifully written, and it's really fun to reread and so much fun to talk to you about it. What I wanted to do is I thought that we should start with you reading the prologue, because
sure.
It will bring everybody into the world of the book, and we will go from there.
Okay, that'd be terrific.
Great.
The prologue will be familiar to some of you who've read the New Yorker piece. It was largely taken from that. A few things added, a few things subtracted. Is this working? Can you all hear me? Okay, good. Thank you all for coming, by the way. So let me try reading this. Usually works. My second grade teacher never liked me much, and one assignment I turned in annoyed her so extravagantly that the red pencil with which she scrawled, "See me," broke through the lined paper. Our class had been asked to write about a recent field trip, and, as was so often the case in those days, I had noticed all the wrong things. This is from my paper. "Well, we went to Boston, Massachusetts, through the town of Warrenville, Connecticut, on Route 44A. It was very pretty, and there was a church that reminded me of pictures of Russia from our book that is published by Time Life. We arrived in Boston at 9:17. At 11, we went on a big tour of Boston on Gray Line 43, made by the superior bus company, Like School Bus 6, which goes down Hunting Lodge Road where Maria lives, and then on to Separatist Road, and then to South Eagleville before it comes to our school. We saw lots of good things, like the Boston Massacre site. The tour ended at 1:05. Before I knew it, we were heading home. We went through Warrenville again, but it was too dark to see much. A few days later, it was Easter. We got a cuckoo clock. It's an unconventional but hardly unobservant report. In truth, as must be obvious, I cared not one bit about Boston on that windy spring day in 1963. Instead, I wanted to learn about Warrenville, a village a few miles northeast of the township of Mansfield, Connecticut, where my family was then living. I had memorized the map of Mansfield, which was available for $1 from our municipal office, and I knew all the school bus routes by heart, a litany I sang out to anybody I could corner. But Warrenville was in the township of Ashford, for which I had no guide, and I remember my blissful sense of resolution when I verified that Route 44A crossed Route 89 in the town center, for I had long hypothesized that they might meet there. Of such joys and pains was my childhood composed. I received a grade of unsatisfactory in social development from the Mansfield Public Schools that year. I did not work to the best of my ability, did not show neatness and care in assignments, did not cooperate with the group, and did not exercise self-control. About the only positive assessment was that I worked well independently. Of course. Then as now, it was all that I could do. In the years since the phrase became a cliche, I've received any number of compliments for my supposed ability to think outside the box. Actually, it's been a struggle for me to perceive just what these boxes were, why they were there, why other people regarded them as important, where their borderlines might be, how to live safely within and without them. My efforts have only partly succeeded. At the age of 55, I am left with a melancholy sensation that my life has been spent in a perpetual state of parallel play, alongside but distinctly apart from the rest of humanity. From early childhood, my memory was so acute and my wit so bleak that I was described as a genius by my parents, by neighbors, and even, on occasion, by the same teachers who handed me failing marks. I wrap myself in this mantle, of course, as a poetic justification that might otherwise have been judged unhinged, and I did my best to believe in it, but the explanation made no sense. A genius at what? Were other geniuses so oblivious that they needed mnemonic devices to tell right from left and idly wet their pants into adolescence? What accounted for my rages and frustrations, for the imperious contempt I showed to people who were in a position to do me harm? Although I delighted in younger children, whom I could instruct and gently dominate, and I exulted when I ran across an adult who was willing to discuss my pet subjects, I could establish no connection with most of my classmates. My pervasive childhood memory is an excruciating awareness of my own strangeness. And so, between the ages of 7 and 15, I was given glucose tolerance tests, anti-seizure medications, electroencephalograms, and an occasional Mogadon tablet to shut me down at night. I suffered through a summer of Bible camp. Exercise regimens were begun and abandoned. The school brought in its own psychiatrist to grill me once a week. Somehow, every June, I was promoted to the next grade, having accomplished little or nothing to deserve it. Meanwhile, the more kindly teachers, recognizing that I would be tormented on the playground, permitted me to spend recess periods indoors, where I memorized vast portions of the 1961 edition of the World Book Encyclopedia simply by skimming through its volumes. A brown carton in my basement contains most of the surviving documents of my elementary school years, and they present a pretty fair portrait of my preteen obsessions. There are intricately detailed street maps of make-believe cities on which I worked silently for hours. Countless crayon drawings of grinning girls with shoulder-length hair and U-shaped smiles, their stick figures fleshed out only by exaggerated biceps. Obituaries of Sophie Tucker, Edward R. Murrow, and David O. Selznick, torn from the Hartford Courant and pasted sloppily into a scrapbook, and any number of meandering and implausible stories, none of them with happy endings. In my darker moods, I think the rest of my life can be quickly summarized. I grew up and into other preoccupations, some of which served me well, without managing to admit the full tide of human experience. I was told that I had Asperger's syndrome in the fall of 2000 as part of what had become a protracted effort to identify and, if possible, alleviate my lifelong unease. I'd never heard of the condition, which had been recognized by the American Psychiatric Association only 6 years earlier. Nevertheless, the diagnosis was one of those rare clinical confirmations met mostly with relief. Here, finally, was an objective explanation for some of my strengths and weaknesses, the simultaneous capacity for unbroken work and all-encompassing recall, linked inextricably to a driven and uncomfortable personality. And I learned that there were others like me, people who yearn for steady routines, repeated patterns, and a few cherished subjects, the driftwood that keeps us afloat. The syndrome was identified in 1944 by Hans Asperger, a Viennese pediatrician who wrote, "For success in science or art, a dash of autism is essential." In his book, Asperger's Syndrome, A Guide for Parents and Professionals, Tony Atwood observed, "The person with Asperger's syndrome has no distinguishing physical features, but is primarily viewed by other people as different because of their unusual quality of social behavior and conversation skills. For example, a woman with Asperger's syndrome described how, as a child, she saw people moving into the house up the street, ran up to one of the new kids, and instead of the conventional greeting and request of, "Hi, you want to play?" instead proclaimed, "9 times 9 is equal to 81. David Mamet, in his book Bambi versus Godzilla, discerned redeeming qualities in the condition. Considering filmmakers past and present, he stated that, quote, "It is not impossible that Asperger's syndrome helped make the movies. The symptoms of this developmental disorder include early precocity, a great ability to maintain masses of information, a lack of ability to mix with groups in age-appropriate ways, ignorance of or indifference to social norms, high intelligence, and difference with transitions, married to a preternatural ability to concentrate on the minutiae of the task at hand." The Asperger's spectrum ranges from people barely more abstracted than a stereotypical, quote, absent-minded professor, to the full-blown, albeit highly functioning, autistic. Symptoms of Asperger's have been attributed ex post facto to renowned and successful individuals, but these are the fortunate ones, persons able to invent outlets for their ever-cresting monomanias. Many are not so lucky and end up institutionalized, homeless, or merely miserable and alone. And yet for some, record collectors with every catalog number at hand, theater buffs with first night casts memorized, children who draw precise architectural blueprints of 19th century silk mills, a cluster of facts can be both luminous and lyric, something around which to construct a life. We are informally referred to as Aspies, and if we're not very, very good at something, we tend to do it very poorly. Little comes naturally, except for whatever random, inexplicable, and often uncontrollable gifts we may have. And even more than most children, we assemble our personalities unevenly, in bits and pieces, almost robotically, from models we admire. For instance, I remember the deliberate decision to appropriate one teacher's mischievous grin and darting eyes, which I found so charming that I thought they might work for me too. A lot of Aspies share certain interests: film, music, electronics, maps, mathematics, history. And we tend to get along instantly if those interests coincide. Yet we are not always natural companions. If, say, you introduce an Aspie devotee of antique piano recordings to one whose passion is vacuum cleaners, chances are that the meeting will result in two uncomprehending and increasingly agitated monologues. So preoccupied are we with our inner imperatives that the outer world may overwhelm and confuse. What anguished pity I used to feel for piñatas at birthday parties. Those papier-mâché donkeys with their amiable smiles about to be shattered by little brutes with bats. On at least one occasion, I begged for a stay of execution and eventually had to be taken home, hysterical, convinced that I'd just witnessed the braining of a new and sympathetic acquaintance. Caring for inanimate objects came easily. Learning to make connections with people, much as I desperately wanted to, was a bewildering process, for they kept changing, and I felt like an alien always about to be exposed. Or, to adapt another hoary but useful analogy, not only did I not see the forest for the trees, but I was so intensely distracted that I missed the trees for the species of lichen on their bark. The author and neurologist Oliver Sacks distinguishes between full-fledged autism and Asperger's syndrome. In The New Yorker some years ago, Sacks wrote that, quote, "People with Asperger's syndrome can tell us of their experiences, their inner feelings and states, whereas those with classical autism cannot. With classical autism, there is no window, and we can only infer. With Asperger's syndrome, there is self-consciousness and at least some power to introspect and report." And so what follows, the story of my childhood, may be counted as one person's attempt to open a window, and I will do my best to keep the report as honest as I can. This necessarily includes the fact that I was a glum little atheist at a precocious age who would only later discern spiritual traces in music, books, film, good company, and an occasional October afternoon. But I can't soften what I felt at the time, for telling the truth about my life seems to be not only the moral imperative of this book, but its sole excuse. I'm not going to put undue stress on my Asperger's syndrome. It will be there, but not front and center, in part because that was only one element of what made me, and in part because I had no idea what it was until I was 45. Nor do I possess the qualifications to write one of those how to cope books. I wish I had some universal wisdom to impart to readers with Asperger's, but I'm still struggling myself, and I expect my struggle to continue until the day I die. All I can offer is a personal chronicle, and sometimes it will be very personal indeed, to a degree that I would have found unbearable when I was younger. So be it. I'm now in my mid-50s, far closer to the end than to the beginning, and I can only be embarrassed for so long.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. But before I start talking with Sasha, I just want to thank you for laughing at what I read. Because, thank you, because so often I've read it and people have been sort of sitting there and getting gloomy. And I hope this book is pretty funny, you know? I mean, it's got serious stuff in it, and it's in many ways a very sad book. But I did my best not to wallow too much in the sadness. And, you know, even I can recognize that a lot of it is, you know, kind of funny. So thank you. I appreciate that. Sasha.
Well, one of the things that I wanted you to read this prologue for many, 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 many reasons, including that it's funny. But it includes parallel play as the title of the book. And you've just told me that the book is going to be renamed, that you're going to lose the subtitle, which is Growing Up with Undiagnosed Asperger's.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I hate that title. I wrote a book called Parallel Play. I was told by my publishers that we needed some kind of subtitle. So we agreed on Life as an Outsider, which was pretty bad, but not that bad. Then they told me that if we put Asperger's in the subtitle, we'd get a whole lot more people buying it. What's happened with that was I agreed to do it, but actually I thought it was wrong then, and I thought it was wrong later, and it ended up making the book, instead of being on the front or in biography section of bookstores, they put it back in self-help or health. Whereas Asperger's is one of the things about the book, there's no doubt about that, but it's not the main thing. Meanwhile, a lot of people have picked up the book thinking it's one of these 101 guides to Asperger's syndrome, like, so you think you have Asperger's syndrome, or, you know, something along those lines, and it's not. And people have gotten very annoyed by it. The fact that it also talks about drugs and sex and rock and roll and a lot of other things, albeit, you know, certainly perceived by me. So I finally talked them into, for the reissue or the paperback edition of the book, it's just going to be called Parallel Play, which is a book that I wrote. Growing up with Asperger's syndrome is certainly part of the story, but it could also be called growing up in Storrs, Connecticut, or growing up mad over the Beach Boys, or, you know, growing up taking drugs across the street from your high school, but those wouldn't have sold so well. So I finally agreed with growing up with Asperger's syndrome, but I didn't like it then, and I dislike it much more now.
Well, one of the themes through the book that gripped me when I read it, and no one ever seems to really talk about it, so I'm going to, is your dance with death. Knowing you, I think it surprised me, but not deeply surprised me, how afraid you are of dying. And I remember that time when I was a little girl, and you realized that you can die. And what is death? And about a page after you finish this prologue, you do this amazing leap, series of leaps, that take you into music criticism. And I want to outline them, and I want to talk about music and music criticism and how that gave you some sort of saving life, a feeling of possibility and saving. You talk about watching records spin, and how much you enjoyed doing that, and that you say, I was emperor of them all and thought I divined everything their sounds had to convey. I was especially drawn to music that was nearly changeless, unfolding slowly and inevitably with few surprises. And you talk about Ravel's Bolero and Carol of the Bells and the Sunrise Movement from Grand Canyon Suite, which actually made me think a little bit about Philip Glass. And I want to get to Philip Glass, to whom you dedicated this book with your three sons. But I was fascinated that at that time, as a young boy, you like these relentless rolling sounds. The next graph, your grandfather dies, Frank Homer Page. He simply vanished, and nobody would give me a satisfactory explanation for where he had gone. Boom, death. Ooh. And then go to a point where you're saying to your mother at night, you know, are you going to die tonight? Well, Dad, am I going to? Will a saber-toothed tiger come back to life and eat me? And these very real things. Next graph, your mother's saying Tim's going to fight this thing. So quite young, she is aware that something's going on. And then Sibelius dies, and your music that you love to listen to of his, you talk about Finlandia, becomes death music. And then Defia dies, and you can't listen to it anymore because it's so associated with these. At the same time, then Mike Kriegsman, the music critic at the time for the San Diego Union, and Sally Ann Kriegsman move into your grandparents' house. Yeah. I mean, what? Part of this is that your life is so charmed in so many ways, and you talk about that charm along with this tremendous loneliness that Asperger's and the Parallel Play brings. And you are talking to Mike about criticism, and he becomes a hero of yours, and you say that his example granted you permission at an early and impressionable age to think and write independently about music. I could imagine no better way to live. And so there's this, in very short order, this salvation from total despair to a grown-up choice to go with your music.
Thank you, Sasha. For those of you who don't know, Mike Kriegsman, who always used the name Alan M. Kriegsman, started off, or when I met him, he was at the San Diego Union before it became the Union Tribune. And he moved into my grandparents' house after my grandfather died, who just disappeared when I was about 2 months short of my third birthday and scared the hell out of me. I don't know what they told me, but it just absolutely freaked me out. He moved in, and he was this music critic, and I was 4 years old, and I thought the idea that this guy went to concerts in the evening and played music, which was already something that, you know, struck me as kind of extraordinary, was pretty terrific. And I mean, I'm trying to think what the odds are that you would have two future Pulitzer Prize-winning critics for the Washington Post living in the same house in the late 1950s, but it happened. And I'm sure that one of the reasons I became a critic was because I had this critic who, as we say, went on to the Washington Post, and then later I joined, and we overlapped by about 1 year, and I'm still in touch with him. He's still living and still married to Sally Ann. But, I mean, for me, I would say that my first 2 or 3 years, and actually most of the rest of my life, was completely confusing unless I heard music, which, for some reason, even at that age, I could entirely understand it. I mean, you know, to use a cliche, it felt like a fish to water. You know, if you put on the music, then I would calm down. Then I wouldn't scream. Then I wouldn't be, you know, hysterical running around the house. So my mom was kind enough to let me ruin all of her records. it was actually great because it was a time when you had 78s. Some of you will remember this, 45s and 33s. And for me at 2 and 3, it was so much fun to play 78s at 33, and it was, you know, and then put on the 33s at 78, you know, and I would just sit there and just watch them go around and be fascinated by the music. It was the first sort of thing that really gave me some sense that there was something out there in the world for me. It became a fascination. And I became a music critic by when I was 9 or 10. Whenever I get a new record, I'd go up and I'd type out some thoughts on the on my dad's IBM, you know, computer before the Selectric, one of these huge bulbous, you know, things.
You were reading by the age of 2.
Yeah, I was.
And your father did that extraordinary, treating you like a laboratory and bringing you
a little bit, yeah,
to in front of people and showing off your brilliance in that, which must have been so odd. And then you find this letter from your father. How did you put this book together? You have such a collection, even including your old drawings. Where did all this come from?
There's one hell of a weird drawing in the book. The way I actually put the book together was I this has to be very personal. I can never really quite tell the difference between what I should share and what I shouldn't share, so I'll just share. My second marriage broke up, and I was really in a terrible situation trying to decide what I was going to do with the rest of my life. And I had written about 3 years earlier to David Remnick, who was the editor of The New Yorker, saying that, you know, I'd been thinking about Asperger's syndrome and maybe I wanted to write something about it. He wrote back, and it was a very affectionate and very nice letter. And he said that, you know, we don't ever pay anybody anything to write something in advance if it's personal, because, I mean, there's so many disasters that can happen. So anyway, we just let it go. And then after this breakup, I was sitting there one day at the Post and I saw a private caller was calling. And I assumed that was a friend of mine who always called with a private number. And so I picked up, and I wasn't picking up the phone that much in those days. And he said, you know, did you ever write that piece? And I said, no, I didn't. And he says, I really wish you would. Would you come up to New York and have lunch with me? And I said, yeah, sure. You know, I'm living in Baltimore, working in Washington. And so he brought me up on the train to New York, took me out for a sushi lunch which without alcohol was something like $120, if you can imagine that. I saw as he was signing it.
I was
thinking like,
this
oh
happens.
My God, you know? In any event, he was very, very nice, and he convinced me that I had to write this thing. And so I sort of grabbed a hold of it, as I mentioned, you know, in the introduction, as a life boy. And I wrote about it, and he liked it, and he printed it. And what was going on that fall was there was some suggestion that I might come to USC as a professor because you were starting up that new program, and I was being considered for that. But it didn't happen right away. You know, it was one of those things where, yeah. So, you know, end of marriage, end of a lot of things, real exhaustion writing about music after, say, 4,000 concerts. And so I finally got this article done. And then I got it had a really strong response. People were very kind, were really interested in the article, and immediately I sold the book. So then I got an invitation to USC as a visiting professor, and I came out there, and I was so busy with my class that I'd signed a contract to have the book done by September 1st, 2008, and it was now June 20th, 2008. And I'd only written the first article. So I'm freaking out, you know. I'm going, what am I going to do? And as sometimes happens to me, you know, after an incredible amount of worry, 5 days just wandering around in a major panic attack, I woke up in the morning and I thought, you know what might actually work is maybe I could get somebody in and I could just talk to this person because I was so alone. I was living in this big house in Baltimore, and, you know, most of my friends were in D.C., and I was just wandering around the house chewing my cuticles and just really scared. But I had this idea, so I called up Remnick's office, and I said, I need somebody who will come up here and work with me for a week or so. And they mentioned a brilliant guy, a guy named Ross Perlin, who's worked for Werner Herzog. He's now about 27. He was then about 25. And the deal I made was I had one of these houses, which, you know, unless you're very rich, you can't imagine in Los Angeles. But in Baltimore, you can buy big, huge old houses. And I just gave him the top floor of my house with the deal that he would come down every morning and talk to me for about 3 hours. And I would leave out my stuff, my old articles, of which I have tons of stuff that I was doing. And he would just ask me things. And he would take notes. And then he would go upstairs after the 3 hours and just transcribe what I'd said for 5 hours.
Didn't you get a stash of things from your mother?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, my mom had always saved my stuff. Yeah.
Right, because these letters that you, the letters that you repeat, and the drawings and the putting together of a life.
Yeah, and stuff that I'd saved. But what he did was he just, you know, he was there for about a week and a half. There's not a single word that Ross wrote in the book. You know, he just took my words and he would ask me questions. But by the time he left, I went from having 5,000 polished words and a total terror attack of what would happen, you know, with this book that I'd promised to Doubleday in 2 months. And he left me with about 80,000 terrible words, you know, lots of ums and ahs and bad descriptions. But at least it was something I could work with. I mean, it was a little bit like being a sculptor and all of a sudden having the marble that I could cut down. So I worked on it like mad. I spent only about 6 weeks on it. In 6 weeks of just obsessive work from about 6 in the morning till about 10 at night, I cut it down to, you know, the book is about 52,000 words.
Well, and you left a lot of your life out. This is not your whole full life.
No,
it's not about Don Powell. It's not.
Yeah.
It's your childhood. And
no Glenn Gould, no Kay Graham, no Don Powell, no Phil Glass, really,
I know.
Except for the dedication. Yeah.
Well, and so let's talk about some of the things that are in it, because you can't say sex, drugs, and rock and roll and not go there. and they are significant parts of the book. You want to talk about any of them and your decisions to be honest about? I mean, one of the things, we'll start with rock and roll because that's easy, right? You hated the Beatles.
Oh, yeah. I hated the Beatles before I started being interested in pop culture. I hated the Beatles when I was 9 because I liked Harry Lauder better and Vernon Dalhart and all these esoteric people who made 78 recordings, and I liked them better. And, of course, I was also being a little bit pompous and putting down my class where everybody else was growing hair and learning how to play guitar. But I ended up liking the Beatles, and I ended up liking a lot of rock, but it really came about when I was about 14 or 15.
Right.
When I was 10, I was very down on it. But I was also, I was terribly conservative. And one thing I've noticed about a lot of people with Asperger's syndrome, and I'm leaving politics out of this, but they tend to be people who like continuity. They do not like big changes in the status quo. They do not like sudden, startling things. They hate surprise parties. So I was like that very much when I was a kid, and I was fascinated by silent films and big movies like Lawrence of Arabia or Dr. Zhivago would cause just cringing in me. You know, it was just too much. I was overwhelmed. I found myself really interested in silent films and in old recordings and in black and white and in history of, you know, X number of years ago. Weirdly enough, in true crime.
Mm.
And that was weird because when I was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, there was this one article I read which said, some people with Asperger's syndrome are very interested in black and white films. They don't like overstimulation.
Really?
They like old records. And they're interested in true crime. And I'm thinking, like, what? Somebody's invented this diagnosis for me, you know?
Well, that must have been incredibly relieving. When you feel like you're an outsider for most of your life, then you get diagnosed and you see people you're not alone.
At that point, it was mostly creepy. I mean, I felt like somebody had snuck in and read my diary. I got more comfortable about it as time went by. And it is strange how many of us are interested in these kind of, you know, statistical things, or, you know, we're able to give you pi to the 150th place, or we can give you all the names and dates of actors and filmmakers, or... What, you know, I mean, it's just funny because we seem to have this.
And yet when you write about music, I don't get the feeling that you're listening to music in a mathematical way, that your language is so visual and that you were so interested in silent film. And to me, the way that the silent film works in your life is almost like a visual counterpoint to the music. Did it inform your writing? Did it inform, because you spent a lot of time in the silent film, and I couldn't get a sense from the book if you were still hooked into music, and what happened to the music part of your life, and how did it come back in?
Well, I mean, I was always fascinated by music, and as I say, it almost felt like an element that was missing from my personality was there when music was playing,
uh-huh.
And music of all kinds. Once I got past that sort of pompous 9-year-old put down of the Beatles and got interested in rock and jazz and, you know, a variety of different kinds of music. You know, I mean, it continues to this day. I mean, I've I spent this afternoon madly in love with an old Stokowski recording of some of the music from Parsifal, you know, and I've carried it with me all day. It's still, you know, welling up my eyes as we're talking about something very different. It was just one of those things which was something that I kind of got. And I didn't get sports, you know, and I didn't get a lot of science, and I didn't get most of what people were interested in. I certainly never got fashion or anything like that. I mean, one of the things which I say in the book, which I've now said so often that it's not entirely true, but it was certainly true when I wrote it, was that if you came up behind me and, you know, closed my eyes and asked me what I was wearing today, I probably wouldn't be able to tell you. You know, it's just not something that makes it into my sensibility. On the other hand, if something is playing in the background as I'm having dinner with somebody, or if something has happened that day that is memorable, that will go into my brain forever. But, you know, I can't tell you what color eyes my parents had or anything like that. Actually, visual is something I'm severely, you know, handicapped in to a large extent, except weirdly enough for film. I mean, I don't really understand visual art very well, or dance, you know, which is something awful to say to a dance critic, but it's just, it's not something that really quite clicks with me. And I don't know why. But some time ago, I just decided, well, you know, that's the way I am, and I'm not going to apologize, and I'm just going to talk about it. As for writing about all the weird things that happen in my life, every now and then, you know, as I say, I am embarrassed. People will come up to me, and they'll bring up something that's so incredibly painful and embarrassing. I'll say, I feel the same way. I'm like, oh, God, you know. When I finally decided to go with the book, I decided I really didn't care what people thought, and that, you know, since it was always so awkward for me to decide whether what I was doing was right or wrong or fashionable or unfashionable, I just go ahead and I just write the damn thing. The only part which I occasionally feel badly about is I said I like to think of the book as a funny book. But the ninth chapter is about an accident I was in when I was 17. I was not driving, but we jumped in the back of a pickup truck with a friend of mine who was very drunk, and we all drove as he drove as fast as he could down a deserted road, and he smashed into a tree and two people died. And the one part of the book which occasionally bothers me, and the only part, I don't care about the awkward sex, I don't care about the drugs, I don't care about the bad LSD trips, you know, those are just personal. The one thing that does bother me is I changed the driver's name, and I did my best to give him sort of a pass on these things, because I have no doubt that any of us in the truck that night, we were so crazy and so full of our own immortality that we could have done the same thing. But, you know, I think about how I would be at the age of 55 if somebody wrote about the very lamest thing I ever did in my life in a small town where everybody will know who it's about, bring it back at this age where you have to re-examine it at the age of 55, something you did at 17 when you were young and very, very stupid. And I felt badly about that. On the other hand, I'm ruthless enough, and I felt that the story had to be told, and I'd thought about this for so many years that I went ahead and did it. And, you know, a couple people have been unhappy about that, but it's something I had to tell.
Well, and your quote that you begin the book with, which to me sums you up as a person, is from Anonymous, the dude in Alexandria. Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. And I feel that force in the book, and that when you're describing the accident, you write about it with great kindness. The people, I mean, it's hard. It's hard to flunk out and to do all the things and to have so many people not understand and not get you. And then this incredible moment of for me with your father, of finding the letter from your father. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because it really is a reconciliation after his death.
The only people who I'm actively cruel to in the book that I know of are my fourth grade gym teacher, who I say perhaps not terribly kindly that she's the only person who I might swerve to hit on a deserted road. And then when I was in Venezuela, I was in Venezuela back before it was a cause, back when it was sort of a, you know, just almost like a 51st state. And my dad went down there to teach in the late 60s and took me away from my hometown. It was in Venezuela that I really started acting out. It was there where I started smoking pot and started to drink and started to smoke cigarettes and, you know, started to chase women around. And I was such a braggart about myself. And I made everybody think there that I was really some kind of really cosmic hippie. I mean, think Dennis Hopper and Easy Rider, and that was what I was trying to be at 15. And I was thrown out of school because I'd made it so clear that I was this crazy pothead, and I'd smoked twice when I was down there. But I was I was determined that I was going to be cool, and it seemed to me that that was the way to be cool, was to listen to rock and smoke pot and do all this stuff. And it was funny because the school kicked me out, and they kicked me out really in a very sort of seamy and awful way by telling me that they wanted to talk about my problems and setting me up with a shrink, and, you know, even then not knowing what to keep quiet, I went on and on about all the kids who I was smoking pot with and who the hip kids were, and it all went to the principal, and it all went to the superintendent, and then they all swooped on these kids. So I'd become sort of a fink before I'd ever even thought about it, because I thought I was just being honest with a therapist, but the therapist was in the pocket of the people. And it was funny because I was thrown out of school, and my dad was horrible to me after I was thrown out of school and was really hostile about it. And then about 9 years later, when we were moving from Storrs, Connecticut to Duke University, I found a letter that he had written to the principal, which he had said he wasn't sharing with me and hadn't shared with me, where he really stood up for me. And he said, you know, this is not a bad kid, you know? And everybody treated me as a bad kid. And I felt a bad kid, and I felt that I'd sort of ruined my life. I'd also, just before that, become kind of famous as a young filmmaker, and I'd had this moment of glory where a guy made a film about me, which won awards, and I was on various PBS shows. And so well, I felt like a complete ruin.
It was a huge big deal. This film is a day with Timmy Page.
Yeah.
And you got awards from Kodak, and then Time Magazine.
Signed autographs at 14. You know?
Yeah. And Time Magazine came up and was doing stories about you. And out of that, you got to meet Marshall McLuhan. I am so jealous. I mean, this was, you were young. This is incredible.
Yeah, it was weird. And the funny thing was, my dad didn't tell me that he defended me for another 9 years. And we spent most of the 70s not talking to each other because I was so enraged that he couldn't see, you know, what was going on with me. And actually, you know, I was diagnosed with Asperger's in 2000, and I think my dad had it. And something I don't mention in the book was that I was diagnosed when my son was diagnosed with it. It's terribly, terribly hereditary. I have two kids who don't have it. I have two siblings who don't have it. My dad had three siblings who didn't have it. But it goes through, or seems to go through, families. I only talk about now, it's not in the book, I talk about the fact that I was diagnosed when my middle son was diagnosed, only because he's now a legal adult, and he's not ashamed of it at all. He's one of these kind of Aspie radicals, you know, who's like, you know, I mean, he told me something wonderful, which was, when you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism, you know, and I think it's really true. But anyway, back to my dad. I didn't know that he'd written this. It was a 4,000 word letter to the principal and the superintendent, basically saying that, in fact, I was hardworking, I was awkward, I'd gotten C's, D's, and F's really all my time. Nobody understood why I could recite the names and the dates of all the presidents and their wives, and I could do it backwards mm-hmm. if you wanted them, but I couldn't pass elementary algebra. I couldn't pass anything like that because the moment I'd sit in a class, I'd be like, and, you know, the class would be over. And then I'd even do things like go to take makeup classes, but I couldn't concentrate. And I was interested in the things that I was good at and totally uninterested in the things that I wasn't good at. And in those days, the idea that anybody with autism would be able to be, you know, fairly communicative and could actually be rather articulate, it just wasn't seen that way. People with autism were supposed to be these people who just rocked back and forth and grunted and never spoke. I mean, I remember reading something as recently as 1997 or 8 saying that, you know, autistic people, most of them never speak, and those who do speak tend to speak in a very, you know, grand and exaggerated fashion. Well, you know, for me, speaking about what was going on in my brain was incredibly easy. I just couldn't figure out what was going on in anyone else's brain. And one of the things that was truly helpful for me was, you know, I borrowed my mother's copy of Emily Post's Etiquette. And for me, it was sort of like a grammar of emotion. I could read it and I could figure out why people felt this way where I'd never understood it before. You know, there's this really nice girl in the 7th and 8th grade that I remember. And I was utterly fascinated with her because she had this huge sort of Cro-Magnon jaw, you know? And I thought she looked great. So I'd come up to her every day and I'd say, "It's so cool, you look like a monkey." And she'd start, she'd start crying, you know? And I'd be like, I wasn't trying to hurt her. I thought it was so much cooler than the rest of us, you know? And of course she'd cry and she'd be terribly upset. I didn't realize that I was hurting her feelings. I honestly didn't. And so reading this book sort of showed me why you treated people in one way and why certain people wouldn't want it if you'd go up to them and, you know, make comments about their looks or something like that. And, you know, as I say, for me, it was really like finally I understood how people work. But it was because they explained what was going on to me. And no one ever explained it. They just give me a rule. And if someone gave me a rule and I didn't understand why they were telling me this, as far as I'm concerned, it was like, you know, some parrot spouting gibberish in my ear, you know? But once I understood, I could actually, you know, work it. I'm sorry, I tend to go on.
Well, no, and we have a rule, which which is weird to throw it open to questions from the audience right about now. So we'd like to do that. And there are microphones here.
A microphone.
I see a
Phil
question
Donahue
over here.
Out there.
Hello.
Hello.
For the last 10 years, I work with children with autism or Asperger's, and I don't really have a lot of older clients, so I kind of wanted to know what it was like for dating and relationships later on in life.
Oh, God, awful. ever in hear the question? I was just really awkward about it, you know? I didn't understand that I was, in fact, trying to make a connection with a human being, and I'd put people kind of on pedestals. I got married when I was about 29 to somebody who'd become a really, really good friend of mine, but we never really got along. But, you know, I mean, just to show you where I was, I sort of looked at the calendar and said, I'm 29, you know, this is the age you're supposed to get married, you're supposed to have children, and so this must be what a real relationship is like. Now, this is long before I knew I had Asperger's syndrome, and so I did get married, and so we had I'm still incredibly fond of her, and we had 3 children together, but it was very, very awkward, and we really didn't get along very well. And I have to say that the first time I really fell in love was maybe when I was in my 40s after this relationship had broken up. And I finally met somebody who was very calm and very steady and very supportive. You'll find that a lot of Asperger people really respond to and are deeply devoted to strong women, because were so awkward. I don't mean physically necessarily, but we're so awkward and we're kind of standing there like this and we need somebody to sort of pull us into life. Mm-hmm. And that happened to me when I was in my 40s, but you know, that broke up too. And, you know, I've been, you know, I mean, it's, you know, I love my children, but I always felt that I should leave them be to do what they want, which I think is partially just my Asperger's syndrome, but I think it's also partially my dad, who really wanted me to be sort of some kind of brilliant little prodigy. And so I've always kind of let my kids alone. You know, I'm still, I mean, people sometimes say, you're so awkward to people. How come you can sit in front of a room like this and talk about this stuff? And this is easy. And you could let another million people in, because here I know exactly what's expected of me. You want to hear me talk about, you know, this condition and about my life. And that I'm okay at. And I don't mind if it's lots of people. I have no problem on television. I have no problem being interviewed. I have no problem talking about this. It actually feels very comfortable. However, you put me in a party situation where nobody knows who I am or my condition, or, you know, or, and I don't know what's expected of me, and I'm a disaster. I can't do it. I'm fine in teaching. I'm fine in a lot of things, but if it comes up to, I mean, I remember myself as a kid when all the kids were going to dances and parties and stuff, and I'd just sit there looking at the ground and hoping that somebody would come up, you know, who I could talk about silent movies all night to, and, you know, that was pretty rare. So I see a hand.
Hi.
Hi.
My daughter is right here, and she was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome at age 34, and she's now 36. And I wanted to ask you, and she probably wants to ask you too, but it's hard for her to ask the question. The hardest thing for us, and for me and for her, is trying to explain her to people, and for her trying to explain herself to people, because people always seem to think they understand, but they don't understand. And
right.
The process of really getting people to understand the kinds of things that you've been talking about, the social the social difficulties, the inability to function in a group, the party, all of those kinds of things, to explain that is exhausting, and then
yeah.
They don't get it anyway.
Yeah,
so
they don't get it anyway.
I'm wondering how you handle that in your, you know, sort of elevated life that you live.
Well, I mean, for me, it's helpful that I can actually talk about these things, and now I'm very specifically trying to talk about these things as much as I can. But you know, the fact is that people can commiserate and they can sympathize and they can often sort of find you interesting, but they're probably not ever entirely going to understand. And so you kind of, you know, eventually you just say, well, you know, that's kind of it. And you know, I mean, I think a lot of Asperger people are very good mimics. I know I was. I learned how people got along with each other, and it doesn't mean that I didn't feel. I did feel, but it gave me a way of expressing my feeling rather than, you know, putting my shoe behind my head or something, which is the way I sort of handled it when I was a kid. I mean, the line I use to explain Asperger's syndrome is I say something along the lines, and this usually kind of works. I say it's the absent-minded professor times five, you know, which you know, gives us a break, which means that we, you know, people will understand something that's within their field of experience, but they don't understand how far it goes, and they don't understand, you know, the various things. And, you know, I was delighted by your daughter's, you know, comments and clapping earlier, and it makes me happy, because it's nice to know that people actually, you know, get some of this, and we do tend to understand each other, and I find that there are certain people I meet, not always Aspies, but a lot of them are Aspies, where it's just like, you know, I see them and it's just like, I understand this person. This is somebody I know. this is somebody I love. This is somebody who gets me. And that's, you know, that's a really nice feeling. And then also I find that, you know, there are all these myths about Asperger's syndrome, that we don't have empathy, that we don't have a sense of humor. In fact, I found that a lot of Aspies have hilarious senses of humor, and it's one of the things that people like about us, because we'll say things which other people would not think to say. I mean, my son, when he was 9 and he was being diagnosed as schizophrenic and being diagnosed as all these things before we were both diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, we were in the Hartford train station once, and we saw this very buttoned-down man in a 3-piece suit with a walrus mustache and glasses, and my son, who was, you know, being thrown out of school, suddenly turns to me and says, "Look, that man's doing a William Howard Taft impersonation." You know, and of course, that's a very weird comment from a 9-year-old. It's also hilarious, and it was also dead on. You know, I was just like, you know, because he did, you know, and it was obvious at that point that this kid, who didn't know things about how to dress, how to treat people in his class, did in fact know what William Howard Taft looked like and could actually use it as humor. More questions. I see somebody back in the row. I see a couple people back there.
You mentioned not liking change and being startled by that. Did that affect you as a music critic when you heard new music and you couldn't assimilate it? Or, I mean, how did that influence your...
Fortunately, I came along when lack of change became very fashionable in new music. The fact of the matter is, though, I was fascinated by all sorts of unusual music, and it was something I got, you know? It could be very, very far out there. It could be Webern or Stockhausen, and I could actually just get it, you know? For whatever reason, people talking in, you know, standard English, I wouldn't understand, but people, you know, doing 2-hour electronic epics with all sorts of, you know, weird tape things, I would understand entirely. And then when Steve Reich and Phil Glass came along, their early stuff, I mean, for me, it was an instant ecstasy, just something which I listened to this, and I was like, oh, my God, I've been waiting for this music all my life. Mm. I still feel that way about a lot of the early music from that period. And it's one of the reasons I dedicated the book to Phil Glass, in part. Aside from that, he was also very kind to me when I was first getting involved in things, and you know, I played his music on the air, and you know, he understood that I understood something about his music, although I would not call him Asperger at all. Yes, I.
In my family, we've just had a new diagnosis of Asperger's for a child that is about 6 or 7 years old. And the first signals of something wrong is gross, severe intestinal ailments. Is that typical of Asperger's or not typical?
I don't think it was true of me, although it might have been looking back. I mean, it could have been, but... I was so sort of far into my own world, and I really didn't learn how to control it when I wanted to pee until I was in my teens to some extent. So I guess that fits. But for me, again, it was just I was oblivious. You know, it was as oblivious as how I put on my shirt, you know, or how I did anything like that. I just really didn't care for the longest period of time. And then I realized that it was definitely something that was a turnoff to women. For me, it was extremely helpful to go through puberty, because all of a sudden I had this urgent physical need, and it sort of taught me that I could not be the sort of, you know, person running around, you know, wildly that I'd been. And it was when I first started to try to find some kind of contract with the outside world. But I guess I'm not really answering your question. I will say that a lot of people with Asperger's syndrome, they don't understand why you're telling them these things, but they'll also understand things that are really quite profound, and will understand music or film or literature or something like that at a very early age. But you'll have to just explain things. And I think, you know, you may have to with your Aspie kid go a while, but there will probably come a time, because we tend to be very logical, almost absurdly logical, and there may come a time when you'll be able to say to your kid that, you know, this is just not what you want to do, because there will be repercussions. And of course, we're always bullied, you know, and so when we try to figure out how to get out of that bullying, and especially once we start getting major crushes on people, we do our very best to get into the quote-unquote real world. So I see a hand over there. Yeah.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm an adult with Asperger's. I'm curious about your career path. Obviously, you're now seem to be a very successful professor, and you've been a music critic. Has it always been so easy? And you mentioned when in your reading that there were people that end up homeless, and it's a shame, because I think nearly all of them have tremendous talent. What advice would you have for someone like myself, who's actually interested in teaching, doesn't really know where to get started?
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, I don't know you at all, so I can't make any comments about this. But my guess is that you probably have a sensitivity to, you know, awkward and unusual kids. They'll probably stand you in very good stead if you become a teacher. I mean, for me, I became a music critic, which was one of these things where I was able to, you know, just write and scribble down things all by myself and live a very solitary life. I reached a point where, at about the age of 44, where I thought I'd gotten rid of all my problems. This is, again, before the Asperger diagnosis. And I went out and I took a job as a administrator at the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. And I was an unbelievable disaster, you know. I'd gotten very smug. I'd won a Pulitzer. I'd done all these things. And I thought, man, I can now do all this stuff. And then when I was dealing with 115 people, all with different ideas, I suddenly realized that I was in the worst possible situation. I was able to, you know, cut bait and limp out of there. But even at this age, if you put me behind a counter at a drugstore or having to sell something which I didn't firmly believe in, I'd just be a disaster. I mean, I would melt down very, very quickly, because you're dealing with surprises every other person. And what I've done with my life, I don't think I've closed down too many things for me, but what I've done with my life is I've tried my damnedest to find situations that are congenial for me, and then just not to step out of them unless I have to. I don't drive at the age of 55 because, you know, in part because I know I'm a space shot, in part because I don't want to be in that kind of competition with people. I try to be sort of anonymous and just work on things that I know I'm good at. So I would say the first thing is to try to decide what you might be good at, find some people to support you and support other people, you know, and then go with that. I should add one more thing about this, about Asperger's syndrome, which is, I've totally forgotten it. So anyway.
You know, I was thinking, oh my God, you traded in St. Louis Symphony with 150 people with ideas to work with me, and I have 150 ideas a day, and it probably drives you nuts.
But I know you.
I know.
And you know, and I'm like, comfortable
I'm
with
sorry.
You, and I love that idea. And I, you know, and I, you know, it's very comfortable when you're in situations where you have some idea of what's going to come towards you. And then I'm fine, you know. And also, I should say, I've gotten to a point where I'm fine even at parties if I can't possibly avoid them. And if I'm going, and what I do, I mean, the analogy I use is say all of us are about to take a plane trip, and we're going to take a plane trip to San Francisco, so we know it's going to be an hour. It's a very different sensibility than if we say we're going to take a plane trip and we're going to Australia, which will be 16 hours.
Yeah.
But in the 15th hour of being on the trip to Australia, because you know it, you won't be panicking, you won't be weirding out, you won't be furious, you won't want to open the door and jump out. Whereas if you're going to San Francisco and it's 3 hours, 4 hours sitting on the runway, you'll go nuts. So what I basically do is I try to decide for myself and prepare myself and say, I'm going to a party for 2 hours. I can do it for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to deal with some strangers in an unusual situation for 2 hours. I can do it. You can prep yourself, or so I find as I get older, which I couldn't do when I was younger, but I can do now. And then if you know what's going to happen, it's fine. Now, if something goes on for too long, or there's somebody who's really, like, sort of pecking at you, you know, then it's
well,
tough.
That's a bad party. Yeah, you got to get out. Yeah. We have time for one more question. One more question.
I'll try to answer quickly if we have two, but I see a question over there.
Thank you. I'd like to know, please, what was your reaction when you were diagnosed, when you found out that you had Asperger's?
Fascination, you know, I mean, frankly, I was dumbfounded. I was, as they say, gobsmacked, you know, I was just amazed. I could not believe reading this book. And it was actually, I eventually got the Tony Atwood book, which is the book I recommend that any of those of you who are here just to get one book on Asperger's, this is not it. This is a book, and it's a book that I hope you'll like, but it is not Asperger's 101. I read these books and I just was like, God, that's what it was about, you know? Huh. I get it. This is why I was having, and I just had my crash and burn in St. Louis, which was a real crash and burn. Mm. And then all of a sudden I thought, no, I haven't outgrown this. I've learned how to work my life around and choose certain things that I'm good at. And so I'd have to say relief. I'd have to say sort of understanding from then on, you know, things that would be good for me, and making that decision on whether it was worth it trying to make this happen and marshaling my strength to go through something or just to run away, you know? I mean, I like to hope I'm a good colleague at USC, and I attend the meetings. I really, really like the people I work with. But, you know, because I'm upfront about my Asperger's syndrome, I think they more or less understand when I'm there for 15 or 20 minutes at a party, and then I flee, because that's the first thing that goes on when I'm in some unstructured situation where I'm just supposed to be, you know, one cog in the wheel. And, I mean, this sounds spoiled. And maybe it is. Maybe, you know, and for most of my life, I was told that, you know, well, you just got to do this. And I never really learned how to do it. And I don't think I can do it. And so I do my best to work around this, but still without, you know, hiding and not ever trying anything new. I can enjoy things that are new, sort of, sometimes.
I want to thank you all for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.
And
thank you very much.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.
Thank you.